What if your chronic exhaustion, your high blood pressure, and even your inability to lose weight aren't signs that your body is failing, but, signs that it's actually succeeding?
It really completely flips the script, doesn't it? I mean, we are so accustomed to viewing illness as a breakdown of the machine.
We really are. And, for you listening to this right now, just think about the standard medical advice you've probably heard a million times for avoiding chronic disease.
Right, the usual list.
Yeah, exactly. Eat better. Exercise more, reduce your stress, stop doom scrolling. But if you're like most people, you've also found out how incredibly, just frustratingly hard it is to actually follow that advice for more than a few weeks.
It's nearly impossible for a lot of people, yeah.
Right. So today we are doing a deep dive into a groundbreaking 2026 academic white paper. It's by Dr. Bitara Sahili, and it's titled Noncommunicable Disease and the Worlds We Can Serve.
And I really think this deep dive is going to fundamentally shift how you view your own health.
Absolutely. The core mission here is to unpack this radical new medical framework. It basically argues that your chronic disease isn't a lack of willpower. It's actually your body executing a highly successful survival strategy, in a world that is actively making you sick.
Yeah, the paper introduces this concept called organism niche miscoupling.
Organism niche miscoupling.
Right. And suggests that the diseases we struggle with most, so diabetes, heart disease, chronic respiratory issues, they're actually conserved patterns of living.
Wait, what does conserved mean in that context?
It means your biology, your emotional state, the commercial environment you live in, the food systems, all of it is recursively stabilizing a trajectory that produces disease.
Okay, let's unpack this because my immediate reaction, and I'm sure, the reaction of a lot of people listening, is to just throw up a defensive wall right there.
Oh, sure. It's a very natural reaction.
Right, because if we start blaming our environment for our health, if we say, the commercial environment made me do it, or my stressful job made me do it, the fast food billboard made me do it.
You're worried it becomes an excuse.
Exactly. Aren't we just handing ourselves a massive gilded excuse to sit on the couch and eat junk food? Like, how does this not completely erase the concept of personal responsibility?
Well, as I said, it is the most natural pushback to this framework. But the author actually anticipates this and frames it very differently.
Okay, how so?
This isn't about absolving you of responsibility at all. It is about understanding the actual physical conditions under which responsibility is biologically possible. Think about it like this. If you are standing in the ocean and you're constantly fighting a riptide, telling you to simply swim better or, be more responsible, that's not a medical strategy.
Right, it's just a recipe for drowning.
Exactly. To truly grasp what responsibility looks like, we have to look past the standard risk factors we are all used to.
Right, the whole risk factor model.
Yeah, and we have to dive into the actual biology of how living things interact with their environments.
Which brings us to that risk factor model itself, because that is the absolute bread and butter of modern medicine, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's everything.
You go into the clinic, they check your blood pressure, they calculate your BMI, they ask how many drinks you have a week.
Right.
And I should say, the paper is very careful to state that we aren't throwing this out. The risk factor frame remains completely indispensable for tracking disease.
Yes, very important to note. The conventional model is undeniably brilliant for tracking what is happening.
It gives us the data points.
Exactly. It tells us that, high blood pressure and a diet high in ultra-processed foods are statistically associated with a cardiac event.
But the argument is that it has a fatal blind spot.
Right. What it completely fails to explain is why those disease-producing patterns are conserved in everyday life.
Right. Like, why does the patient keep eating that diet when they know it's harmful?
Precisely. Or why does their blood pressure remain sky high despite the doctor explicitly telling them to just relax?
Yeah, relaxing is easier said than done.
It is. And the risk factor model, by stopping at the what, unintentionally moralizes the disease.
I see.
It takes these massive structural, environmental, and emotional pressures and shrinks them down into a single point of individual moral failure.
Which creates that classic, really frustrating medical narrative, right? The whole, why is this patient non-compliant thing?
Exactly. That word comes up a lot, non-compliant.
And to dismantle that narrative, the paper brings in the work of Humberto Maturana. He was a pioneering Chilean biologist.
Yes, his work is foundational here.
And he developed this framework called the biology of living. The absolute foundational concept we need to understand here is something called autopoiesis.
Autopoiesis is just a beautiful concept. The word itself translates roughly to self-producing.
Self-producing, okay.
Yeah, Maturana argued that a living being is a self-producing unity. You are not a machine.
Unlike a car, right?
Right. If you have a car, it's an allopoietic machine. It produces something other than itself, like transportation, and it takes very predictable inputs.
You put gas in, you get combustion out.
Exactly. An autopoietic organism, however, continuously produces itself.
So our cells.
Yet your cells are constantly dying and rebuilding, conserving their own organization based on their structure and their history.
Wait, let's pause on that phrase, conserving their own organization. Are we just talking about basic homeostasis here?
Not exactly.
Like my body sweating when I walk outside on a hot day to keep my temperature stable?
Yeah.
Or is Maturana getting at something deeper?
It's much deeper than temperature control, yeah. Homeostasis is really just about keeping a specific variable stable.
Okay.
Autopoiesis is about maintaining the entire network of processes that makes you a living thing.
Wow.
Your body is constantly taking in feedback from the environment and literally rebuilding your cellular structure to survive whatever environment you happen to be in.
And clinically, that distinction changes everything, doesn't it?
It really does. Because a patient is not a machine where a doctor can just insert a medication or, you know, hand them an informational pamphlet.
Just an input.
Right, an input. You can't just give an input and expect a perfectly predictable mechanical behavioral output.
Because the human is constantly adapting.
Exactly.
Which leads to another massive concept in the paper, structural coupling.
Yes. Structural coupling is key.
So through recurrent daily interactions, the organism and its environment become fitted to each other. They couple.
Right.
And the scary part is this coupling can generate robust health or it can generate profound disease.
Absolutely. Your eating patterns, your circadian rhythms, your baseline stress levels, they don't just magically appear as random, isolated choices you make in a vacuum.
Right. You don't just wake up and choose to be stressed.
No. They emerge through repeated daily structural coupling with your family dynamics, your workplace demands, your culture, the local economy.
It fundamentally changes how we view symptoms, then.
It does. Symptoms aren't just gears grinding in a broken machine.
Right.
Maturana introduced this idea of cognition as living. In his view, living itself is a cognitive process. The organism is constantly making embodied sense of its domain.
Oh, so things like chronic fatigue or an insatiable appetite for sugar or heightened metabolic regulation.
Yes. These are the body's way of making sense of life under extreme constraint.
I keep thinking about a houseplant.
A houseplant.
Yeah. If you have a fern and you stick it in a dark, dry, overheated closet, it's going to wilt. It's going to turn yellow.
Oh, definitely.
But you don't open the closet door, point at the fern, and say, wow, this plant is incredibly non-compliant. It really lacks the willpower to stay green.
That's a great analogy. You'd recognize immediately that the plant is structurally coupled to a terrible environment.
Right.
It's adapting to a lack of light and moisture by wilt, you know, to conserve whatever minimal energy it has left.
The wilting isn't a malfunction.
Exactly. It is a brilliant, albeit desperate, survival strategy.
Right. But if we take that plant analogy further, humans have layers of complexity that plants just don't have. I mean, we don't just need sunlight and water.
No, we certainly don't.
The paper brings in two incredibly human concepts here, emotioning and languaging. And I feel like this is where the medical model really gets challenged.
What's fascinating here is that Maturana didn't view emotions the way we typically do in pop psychology.
Just as, like, fleeting internal feelings.
Right. He defined emotioning as the actual bodily states that dictate what actions are possible for an organism at any given moment.
Oh, wow.
Think about a patient living in a state of chronic, suffocating shame or perpetual financial fear or deep grief.
Yeah.
They inhabit a completely different physical world of possible conduct than someone living in a state of trust, security, and dignity.
So handing a deeply exhausted, financially terrified person a printed sheet of dietary guidelines,
it rarely changes their behavior because information alone cannot penetrate an emotional field that has closed off the possibility of change.
You listening, think about the last time you left a doctor's office or even a meeting feeling deeply judged or guilty.
That's a horrible feeling.
It is. Notice how your body physically felt in that exact moment of shame. The tightness in your chest, the shallow breathing, the urge to just shrink down and hide. That isn't just a subjective feeling. That is the biological state of avoidance.
Exactly.
And it connects perfectly to languaging. The author says, we live in language. So when a doctor writes, patient is non-compliant in a chart, or when a patient internalizes that and says, I just have no willpower, those are not neutral observations.
No, they aren't. Language physically alters our emotional world. Words can literally close off our biological capacity for action.
So using a label like non-compliant,
it deepens that state of shame. And a body steeped in shame is physiologically organized for defense and avoidance.
Wow.
It's not organized for healing or creative problem solving.
Which makes total sense.
This is why the paper introduces a concept that sounds almost shocking in a clinical white paper.
Oh, right. The biology of love.
Yes.
I have to admit, when I first read that, it sounds like poetry, not medicine.
It does sound poetic, but he means it in a strict evolutionary and biological sense.
Okay, break that down for me.
In this framework, love is simply the relational domain where another person is allowed to appear as a legitimate other in coexistence with you.
A legitimate other. Okay.
That's right. So in the context of chronic disease care, treating a patient with dignity, genuine curiosity and respect, those aren't just soft skills.
Or just a bonus feature of having a good bedside manner.
Exactly. They're absolute biological imperatives.
Because feeling seen actually changes the body.
Yes. Feeling seen and legitimized physically widens a patient's domain of possible action. It gives their nervous system the physiological safety required to actually attempt a change.
Okay, so if we accept this premise, right, that our bodies are constantly autopoietic, they're structurally coupling to our environments, and heavily gated by the biology of emotion and language.
Yes.
How does this abstract philosophy actually translate into the biological diseases we see on an MRI or a blood test?
Right, the physical manifestation.
Yeah, like how does a toxic workplace or a really stressful commute literally turn into a blocked artery?
That is the crucial bridge here. And the paper frames it as organism niche coherence versus organism niche miscoupling.
Coherence versus miscoupling. Got it.
Coherence is when your daily recurrent interactions with your environment, so your sleep schedule, your community, your ecosystem, they actually conserve or expand your ability to live viably.
Okay, so you are thriving.
Yes, you are thriving. Your body is repairing itself efficiently. Miscoupling, on the other hand, is the dangerous part.
Miscoupling is when your survival strategies start eating you alive.
That's a very visceral way to put it, but yes, miscoupling occurs when your environment forces you into patterns that allow you to survive today, but progressively destroy your body over the next decade.
Wow.
You become locked into a trajectory of chronic physiological strain. And the insidious thing is, an individual might appear highly adapted to a harmful situation.
What do you mean by that?
Well, an environment like a high-stress corporate job might look stable from the outside. Yeah. You know, they're succeeding, making money.
Right.
But internally, it is biologically pathogenic.
So the outside world literally gets under the skin.
Exactly.
Let's dive deep into the actual physiological pathways. The paper outlines for how a pathogenic niche actually rewires our biology, because this is where it gets really concrete.
Yes, do that.
The first major pathway discussed is allostatic load.
Okay, so let's break that down. Allostasis is your body's process of maintaining stability through change.
So unlike homeostasis, which is just staying the same.
Right. So if you have to run to catch a bus, your heart rate spikes. Your blood vessels constrict to pump blood to your muscles.
That's allostasis.
Yes. And then once you're on the bus, everything settles back down to baseline. That's a healthy adaptive response.
Okay.
But imagine a life of chronic perturbation. You are constantly worried about making rent. Your neighborhood is loud, so you never sleep deeply.
Right. Your inbox is flooded with urgent demands at 11 p.m.
Exactly. Your body's alarm systems never actually shut off.
So the system basically gets stuck in the on position.
Yes. And that generates cumulative wear and tear. That specific biological wear and tear is what we call allostatic load.
Allostatic load.
It is the continuous neuroendocrine activation that eventually degrades your system over time.
And a huge part of that neuroendocrine activation is the autonomic nervous system and the HPA axis, right?
Yes, exactly.
For those who might not know, what does HPA stand for?
The hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis.
Right, okay.
This is your primary stress response system.
Yeah.
When you live with persistent insecurity or social threat, your brain, specifically the amygdala, signals the hypothalamus.
Okay.
Which eventually tells your adrenal glands to just pump out cortisol and adrenaline.
And that's your sympathetic nervous system, right? The fight or flight side.
Exactly. It completely overrides your parasympathetic system, which is your rest and digest side.
And this isn't just about feeling jittery. Like, this has massive physical consequences.
Well, it's not just feeling nervous at all. chronic cortisol elevation physically alters how your cells respond to insulin. It dries up your blood pressure by keeping your blood vessels constricted. It degrades your entire sleep architecture.
Which feeds right into the third pathway the paper mentions, which is immune metabolic coupling and chronic inflammation.
Right. When your HPA axis is constantly firing and your sleep is disrupted night after night, your immune system gets confused.
Confused how?
It starts seeing this chronic stress as systemic damage, and it actually initiates an inflammatory response.
But there's no actual physical wound to heal.
Precisely. So the inflammation just circulates in your system.
Oh, wow.
And this chronic low-grade inflammation is really the root driver of almost everything we fear.
Things like heart disease?
Yeah. Atherosclerosis, where plaque builds up in your arteries. Also insulin resistance, chronic kidney disease, and even severe depression.
Here's where it gets really interesting to me. The paper looks at how these pathways interact with sleep, appetite, and reward, specifically in the context of our modern ultra-processed food environments.
Yes, the food environment is critical here.
The author argues that in many cases, our food behavior isn't actively chosen. It is actually elicited and reinforced by the niche.
Think about the biological reality of someone working a grueling 60-hour week.
Okay.
They are heavily sleep-deprived. This means their ghrelin levels, that's the hormone that signals hunger, are sky high.
And what about leptin?
Their leptin levels, the hormone that signals fullness, are totally suppressed.
Wow, so they're constantly hungry and never feel full.
Right. Plus, their prefrontal cortex, which is the part of the brain responsible for long-term planning and impulse control, is just exhausted.
So they have no biological defense?
None. Now, place that profoundly depleted organism into an environment that is saturated with cheap, heavily marketed, ultra-processed foods.
Foods that are, you know, quite literally engineered in laboratories to hit the bliss point and hijack our dopamine receptors.
Exactly. So when that exhausted worker buys a massive sugary coffee and a processed pastry just to get through the afternoon slump.
You can't just call that a failure of willpower.
No. In the Maturana framework, that is a highly successful, structurally coupled, short-term adaptation.
That makes so much sense.
The body desperately needs immediate, dense energy to survive the extreme fatigue of the environment.
Right.
And it is simply accessing the most efficient source available in its niche.
But the tragedy is that this short-term survival tactic basically guarantees long-term metabolic strain.
Exactly.
You are forced to structurally couple to a food system that is making you sick just so you have the energy to keep participating in an economy that is wearing you out.
It's a brutal cycle.
It is. And all of this stress, this inflammation, this processed food, it all converges on your blood vessels.
Yes.
The paper uses a phrase that actually stopped me in my tracks. The vascular system becomes a recorder of lived exposure.
It's a profound image, isn't it?
It really is.
The endothelium, that's the inner lining of your blood vessels, isn't just a passive pipe that blood flows through. It is an active tissue that responds to everything. It records the molecular signature of the food you eat, the particulate matter in the air you breathe.
It records the cortisol from your stress.
Yes, your lack of sleep, and even the level of relational care and dignity you experience on a daily basis.
Okay, as undeniably logical as that all is, I have to admit it sounds incredibly depressing.
It can definitely feel that way at first.
I mean, so what does this all mean for us? Are we just helpless victims of our zip codes, our algorithms, and our work schedules?
No, not at all.
If my vascular system is literally just a physical tape recorder of all my financial stress, the smog in my city, and the fact that I only slept 5 hours last night, like, how do I hit the erase button?
Well, it is a heavy reality to confront.
Yeah.
But if we connect this back to the bigger picture, this reframing is actually deeply empowering.
Empowering, huh?
Because understanding your body as a recorder of lived exposure rather than an inherently flawed machine, is the exact conceptual shift that allows you to change the inputs.
Because it removes the self-blame.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It removes the self-blame, which, as we already established, biologically blocks action anyway.
Right, the shame loop.
Yeah, it shifts your focus from fighting your own body to actually analyzing and altering the niche itself.
Okay.
You stop staring in the mirror asking, why am I so chronically undisciplined? And you start looking at your environment, asking what specific conditions in my life are making this maladaptive pattern absolutely necessary for my survival today.
So once you identify the constraint.
Yes. Once you identify it, you can begin to co-create a new domain of action.
Wow.
You regain your agency, not by trying to outwillpower your biology, but because you finally see the real board you're playing on.
Because you can't win the game if you don't even know what board you're on.
Exactly.
To see exactly how this plays out on the board, let's look at how this framework completely redefines the most common chronic diseases plaguing society today.
Yes, the paper does a great job of applying this to specific illnesses.
The paper doesn't just present this as a theory, right? It walks through the big killers and contrasts the standard biomedical account with this new organism niche account.
And the way these diseases naturally bleed into one another when you look at the niche is just fascinating.
It really is. Let's start with hypertension.
Okay, so biomedically, when we look at high blood pressure, we look at the mechanics, right? Vascular tone, renal sodium handling, arterial stiffness.
And let me reiterate, treating those mechanics with medication is vital. We aren't throwing that away.
No, absolutely vital. But the organism niche account asks us to look at hypertension conceptually as a life of vigilance.
A life of vigilance, meaning your body feels like it's constantly on guard.
Precisely. If your niche is characterized by chronic stress, structural racism, poor sleep, constant financial pressure,
or the heavy burden of caregiving without any support.
Yes. Your body elevates its blood pressure because it truly believes it needs to remain mobilized for an impending threat. The blood pressure isn't the disease itself. It is the physical manifestation of that constant vigilance.
So the clinical reopening question, which is what the paper suggests a doctor should ask, isn't just, did you take your lisinopril? Yeah. It's, what would reduce this person's need to remain physiologically mobilized?
Exactly. That's the real question.
And here is where we see the cascade effect. If you are living a life of vigilance, your cortisol is spiking.
Yes.
And as we discussed earlier, that cortisol spike drives a desperate biological demand for energy, which pushes us right into the next major disease category.
Obesity and type 2 diabetes.
Right.
The transition is seamless, biologically speaking. Mm-hmm. The old biomedical view of obesity is simply an energy balance equation.
Calories in, calories out, plus some bad genetics.
Right.
A model that has honestly failed millions of people and generated an unbelievable amount of societal shame.
Because it is a wildly incomplete picture of reality.
Yeah.
The new framework views weight not as a moral failing of self-control, but as a history of metabolic adaptation.
A history of metabolic adaptation.
The body is holding on to weight or developing insulin resistance for a very specific reason.
It's a biological coupling to the environment.
Yes. An environment defined by ultra-processed food marketing, trauma, chronic sleep disruption, and the need for emotional regulation through food.
So the reopening question for diabetes shifts from just tracking HbA1c to asking, what conditions would make stable glycemia easier to conserve in daily life?
It's looking for the path of least resistance for the patient's actual lived reality.
And it doesn't stop at metabolism. The paper moves right into chronic respiratory disease. So things like asthma, COPD.
Biomedically, we usually measure lung volume, we look at airway hyperresponsiveness, we ask about tobacco use.
Right.
But existentially, breathing is the most intimate organism-atmosphere coupling we have.
I mean, literally taking the environment into your body.
Exactly. Your lungs are in direct, constant interaction with your housing conditions. Are there mold spores in the walls?
Do you live near a major highway with diesel particulate matter?
Yes. So the clinical question shifts too. What would make safer breathing physically possible in this person's home, work, and community?
And this systemic inflammation, this constant environmental stress, eventually degrades the body's filtration and repair systems over time.
Right.
Which is how the paper addresses chronic kidney disease and even cancer.
Chronic kidney disease, or CKD, is largely the end result of cumulative vascular and metabolic damage.
Over a lifetime of vigilance and metabolic adaptation.
Exactly. So yeah. The reopening question focuses heavily on systemic support.
What would make kidney protection visible, affordable, and continuous long before advanced disease develops?
Yes. And with cancer, while deeply honoring the complex genetics and tissue biology involved, the Majorana framework broadens the entire lens.
It asks us to look at the relational conditions, right?
Yes. The conditions of prevention, environmental toxic exposures, right. The intense financial toxicity of cancer treatment, and the dignity of survivorship itself.
And weaving through all of this, just deeply tangled in every single one of these physical ailments, is mental health.
Because of that concept of emotioning we discussed earlier.
Right.
Your mental state is the literal gatekeeper of your possible actions. If a patient is drowning in depression or chronic anxiety, their world of possibilities physically shrinks.
Yeah.
Movement feels impossible. Cooking a nutritious meal feels like climbing a mountain. remembering to take medication completely falls away.
So the clinical question cannot just be about prescribing an SSRI.
No, it has to ask, what emotional and relational domain would make care, movement, nourishment, and hope feel biologically possible again?
You know, treating these diseases purely biomedically, just handing out the blood pressure pill or the insulin injection while totally ignoring the niche, it feels exactly like bailing water out of a sinking boat without ever bothering to look for the massive hole in the hull.
That's a very potent analogy.
You're just frantically tossing buckets of water over the side, but the water of the pathogenic niche just keeps rushing right back in.
The bailing water analogy is great, but we really need to stretch it further because the paper includes very explicit life-saving safeguards about this.
Okay, tell me more.
The biomedical interventions, the medications, the surgeries, the buckets, bailing the water, those are what keep the patient alive today.
Right.
If someone comes into the ER in a hypertensive crisis or diabetic ketoacidosis, they need the pharmaceutical bucket immediately.
They need it right then.
Exactly. The Maturana-informed framework never once suggests abandoning biomedical care.
Right. If your boat is filled with water, step one is still to grab a bucket. Don't throw away the bucket.
But if you are only bailing water and the boat is still actively crashing against the jagged rocks of a toxic work environment and a food desert,
your arm is eventually going to give out.
Precisely. The organism niche approach is how you grab the rudder, is how you steer the boat away from the rocks and actually patch the hole.
You absolutely need both.
You need the clinical precision of biomedicine to survive the acute crisis and the relational depth of niche transformation to survive the decade. They're completely complementary.
But if this is the biological reality of how diseases are conserved, then the way doctors and patients interact in a standard clinical setting has to radically, fundamentally change.
It absolutely has to.
Because let's be honest, you cannot patch the hull of a sinking boat or steer away from the rocks in a standard 12-minute checkup where the doctor spends half the time typing on a laptop.
You really can't. And that is the exact pivot the paper makes in section 4.
Okay.
The clinical shift from compliance to co-creation.
From compliance to co-creation.
Yes. The conventional medical encounter views the patient essentially as a risk carrier. They are just a target for behavior change.
Right.
The clinician assumes the role of the expert instructor, dispensing data and advice, and the patient is expected to passively absorb and just adhere to it.
And when the patient inevitably fails to adhere, because, you know, their niche won't allow it, the system defaults to blame.
Which induces shame, which, as we know, biologically organizes avoidance, which ensures the disease continues. It's a closed, toxic loop.
So how does the Maturana-informed encounter break this loop?
It views the patient not as a broken machine, but as a living organism deeply embedded in a complex world.
As a legitimate person.
Yes, a legitimate person with a history of structural coupling that makes perfect biological sense.
So the clinician's role has to shift from instructor to observer participant.
Exactly. They aren't handing down tablets from a mountain. They are co-designing reality with the patient.
And to make this incredibly deep philosophy practical for a busy clinician, Dr. Sahili introduces a framework called the CARE method. That's C-A-R-E.
Yes. The CARE method translates Maturana's biology of living into a practical clinical sequence.
So the C stands for contextualize the condition.
Right.
And when I read this, I think about a hypothetical patient. Let's call him Marcus. Marcus has type 2 diabetes.
Okay, Marcus.
In a conventional visit, contextualizing just means looking at Marcus's chart and seeing his blood sugar is up.
But under this new method, the doctor has to ask entirely different questions.
Like, what is Marcus's lived world? What are his work hours? Does he have a grocery store near his house?
Is he caring for a sick parent?
Exactly. But honestly, when I read this, my devil's advocate brain kicks in again.
Oh.
It's one thing to ask a patient about their finances or their commute. It's another to actually know what to do with that information medically.
Right.
How does this not just turn a highly trained physician into an overwhelmed social worker?
It's a vital distinction to make. The goal isn't for the physician to actually solve Marcus's financial problems.
Oh, it's not.
No. The goal is to gather the data necessary to stop prescribing medical interventions that are guaranteed to fail.
Oh, I see.
If you know Marcus works a 12-hour night shift and takes 3 buses to get home, prescribing a medication that requires him to take it with a home-cooked meal at 8 a.m. is a biological impossibility.
Yeah, that's just setting him up to fail.
Contextualizing allows the doctor to establish dignity, the biology of love we talked about, and actually fit the medicine to the reality of the niche.
Which leads right into A, assess conserve patterns. This is about finding the loop, right?
Exactly. The clinician and Marcus look at the map of his life and ask, what specific pattern keeps repeating across your body, your emotions, and your environment?
And again, this is done with zero blame.
Zero blame. It's mutual observation.
So they might realize that every day at 3 a.m., Marcus's energy crashes on his shift. He feels a spike of anxiety about his job security, and he goes to the vending machine for energy drinks and processed snacks just to stay awake.
They map the miscoupling. They identify the exact moment the environment forces the biological compromise.
And then comes R, reopen a feasible domain of action. And the key word here is feasible.
This is where conventional medicine often fails spectacularly.
Yeah, a conventional doctor might tell Marcus, you need to meal prep organic salads and join a gym.
That is a forcing change. It demands energy and time that Marcus's niche simply does not provide. It will fail.
Right. So what does reopening a feasible domain look like?
It means finding one small non-forcing change that alters the coupling. Maybe Marcus can't leave his job or change what's in the vending machine.
Right.
But maybe he and the doctor decide that during his 15-minute break, instead of scrolling on his phone in the break room, he steps outside into the cool air.
Oh, okay.
And he does 2 minutes of deep breathing to shift his autonomic nervous system out of fight or flight before he goes back to the floor.
It's a tiny shift, but it changes the biology of the moment.
Exactly.
And finally, E, embed and evaluate.
This asks, what support will help this new pattern be conserved over time?
So that involves follow-ups, maybe connecting Marcus with a community health worker.
Or bringing his family into the conversation. And crucially, if Marcus comes back in 3 months and the deep breathing didn't work,
it is not treated as Marcus's failure.
No, it is simply treated as new information about the constraints of his niche, and they design a new experiment.
Okay, I love the CARE method. I love what it did for Marcus in our hypothetical scenario, but we really have to confront the massive elephant in the room here.
I think I know what you're going to say.
Our healthcare system is fundamentally not built for this. Primary care doctors are drowning.
They really are.
They have a waiting room overflowing with 20 people. They are buried in electronic health record clicking, and insurance reimburses them based on throughput.
Yes.
How on earth do you execute this deep second order listening and map out a patient's entire social ecosystem in a 12-minute appointment? It feels structurally impossible.
It is structurally impossible under the current model. And the author is actually acutely aware of this.
Okay, good.
The paper dedicates an entire implementation pathway to this exact systemic constraint.
So what's the solution?
You cannot simply drop Maturana's philosophy onto the shoulders of a burned out, deeply stressed physician and say, go fix your patient's niches in 12 minutes.
That would just be adding allostatic load to the doctor.
Exactly. So how do we restructure the system to actually allow this kind of care?
Right. How?
It requires a massive shift toward true team-based care. The physician might handle the precise biomedical diagnosis, the acute risk assessment, and the medication management.
They're managing the buckets.
Exactly. But the coherence assessment, the deep mapping of the care method, that requires an expanded team.
Like who?
It involves nurses, clinical pharmacists, social workers, and crucially, community health workers who actually understand the local niche because they live in it.
It's expanding the definition of healthcare so it doesn't just happen inside the four walls of a clinic.
Yes. It also demands a shift toward NCD registries, where patient populations are tracked and supported continuously in the community, not just when they show up in acute crisis.
And fundamentally, it requires changing the metrics of success, doesn't it?
It does. A conventional system financially rewards throughput, how many RVUs or relative value units, a doctor billed today.
Right.
A life coherent system has to measure and reward shared understanding and whether the patient is actually supported in their daily environment.
Which perfectly highlights the inescapable fact that we cannot just fix the clinic.
No, we can't.
We have to fix the society that surrounds the clinic. And this is where the paper brilliantly scales up in section 5.
It's the macro level.
It moves from looking at the individual patient to looking at public health, viewing entire societies as what the author calls pathogenic niches.
Right. If you zoom out from the individual, non-communicable diseases are basically the population level symptom of a pathogenic niche.
Okay.
If an entire nation has skyrocketing rates of diabetes, hypertension, and heart disease, it is biologically absurd to conclude that millions of completely disconnected individuals simultaneously lost their moral willpower.
Yeah, That makes no sense.
The only logical conclusion is that the macro environment, the institutions, the commercial actors, the agricultural policies, and the built urban environments,
they are actively stabilizing disease-producing patterns on a massive scale. We've engineered a world that makes it incredibly easy, almost frictionless, to get sick, and incredibly expensive and difficult to stay healthy.
That's exactly it.
And to illustrate how this macro-level pathogenic niche operates, the paper uses a very specific, fascinating microcosm, the Caribbean and Small Island Developing States, or SIZs.
Yes.
Specifically, the author looks at the nation of St. Kitts and Nevis.
It's a really brilliant choice for a case study.
Why look at a small island, though?
Because in a small island context, the organism niche framework isn't just an abstract academic theory.
Oh, it's right in front of you.
It is hyper-visible. The vulnerabilities and the feedback loops are right there on the surface, moving at a very accelerated pace.
The paper details several unique vulnerabilities of these island nations. The first massive one is imported food dependence.
Right. Because of constrained agricultural land and historical economic structures, many small islands are heavily reliant on imported food.
Which means?
This means they are flooded with cheap, shelf-stable, globally distributed, ultra-processed foods. Fresh, locally grown, nutrient-dense foods are often significantly more expensive or simply unavailable.
So the population is structurally coupled to an imported food system that is metabolically disastrous.
Exactly.
The paper also dives into the economic pressures of tourism.
These economies are often heavily reliant on the hospitality industry.
Right.
This creates a niche dominated by sedentary service jobs, shift work that destroys sleep architecture, and environments that are heavily saturated with alcohol and rich foods geared toward tourists.
Which then bleeds into and saturates the local culture.
Yes.
And on top of the food and the economy, there is the existential threat of climate vulnerability.
A huge factor for SIDES.
The paper cites the PAHO health and climate change profile for St. Kitts and Nevis, warning of extreme heat, intense hurricanes, and water scarcity. But how exactly does a hurricane cause a non-communicable disease? I mean, it's not an infection.
A hurricane causes a massive, instantaneous disruption to the niche. Think about the biological cascade.
Okay, walk me through it.
A major storm hits.
Yeah.
The local food supply chains are severed, meaning only highly processed, non-perishable foods are available for months.
Right.
The power grid goes down, which means diabetics cannot refrigerate their insulin. The psychological trauma of losing a home or a livelihood creates an immense chronic spike in allostatic load.
And if the local coastal clinic is flooded, your continuity of care is severed.
Exactly. The organism niche miscoupling isn't a slow drift in this case. It is violently forced upon the population by the climate.
It's a perfect storm, literally and biologically.
Yes.
But the paper doesn't just use small islands to show us doom and gloom. It highlights that these nations possess incredible, unique assets that larger nations don't have.
They absolutely do. Because of their geographic size and population density, small islands have intense social proximity.
Right. Everyone knows everyone.
Yes. There is a deep web of community trust. And crucially, there is a highly visible, immediate feedback loop between a government policy decision and the lived reality of the citizens.
Yeah.
It is entirely possible to mobilize coordinated community-scale transformation much faster in St. Kitts and Nevis than it is in a massive, sprawling, politically fragmented country.
The paper mentions how local institutions, churches, schools, neighborhood sports clubs can all rapidly become what it calls infrastructures for conserving healthier ways of living.
If a local church initiates a community garden project, or if the island government passes a swift regulation restricting the marketing of ultra-processed foods within a certain radius of the island schools,
the entire niche begins to shift toward coherence almost immediately.
Yes. The biology of the population responds to the new environment.
And honestly, the more we discuss the small island example, the more obvious it becomes that this is just a microcosm for the entire globe.
It really is.
I mean, the vulnerability to climate stress, the inescapable reach of globalized ultra-processed commodities, the stress of modern economies, these forces affect everyone, whether you're living in St. Kitts, downtown London, or suburban New York.
Yes, it's just that on an island, the boundaries of the niche are surrounded by water, making the mechanics undeniable.
That is the ultimate takeaway. The small island developing state shows us the concentrated blueprint of our global health crisis and potentially the blueprint for a global solution.
But to actually manage that solution, to steer the ship on a societal level, we need a fundamentally new way to measure whether we are succeeding or failing.
Yes. Which brings us to one of my absolute favorite concepts in the entire paper, the Life Coherent NCD Dashboard.
Currently, when public health officials look at how a city or a country is doing, they look at biomedical indicators.
Right. They track mortality rates, average population blood pressure, HbA1c levels, smoking prevalence.
And as we said, this is necessary data, but it is dangerously insufficient for creating health.
I think of it like modern vehicle telemetry.
Oh, telemetry.
Yeah. In an old car, the dashboard was incredibly basic. You had a speedometer and a gas gauge.
Right.
That's your blood pressure and your BMI. But if you look at the dashboard of a modern high-tech vehicle or an airplane, it's not just looking internally at the engine.
It's looking outside.
Exactly. It's checking the external weather conditions. It's monitoring the traction of the road surface. It's using sensors to see if the driver's eyes are drooping because they haven't slept or if the car is drifting out of its lane.
That analogy captures the shift perfectly.
Thanks.
The traditional medical dashboard only tells you that the engine is currently overheating. The Life Coherent NCD dashboard adds the vital telemetry indicators that tell you why the engine is overheating and whether the road ahead is actually navigable.
So it insists that we must measure lift coherence indicators right alongside the biomedical ones.
Yes.
What exactly are we measuring with these lift coherence indicators?
We need to start measuring the actual conditions of the niche. What is the sleep quality across different socioeconomic demographics?
What is the reality of food access and diet quality in specific neighborhoods?
Movement safety. Is it actually safe, physically and socially, for an elderly person to walk in their community? We need to measure baseline stress load, emotional well-being, and the level of trust the population has in their care providers.
And the paper expands this even further into system and niche indicators.
Yes, maybe. Measuring the macro structures. Are we tracking primary care continuity? Are we measuring the actual walkability and green space of a city design?
Are we monitoring air quality and clean water as fundamental health metrics?
Are we evaluating whether our public policies are genuinely focused on equity?
The fundamental question the public health dashboard asks completely changes. It goes from, is the disease medically controlled, to is healthier living becoming structurally easier to conserve?
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, it completely redefines what constitutes a medical intervention.
How so?
When you look at the whole dashboard, suddenly a city planner building a safe walking path, or a local government funding a community agricultural garden,
or legislators enforcing strict regulations on how ultra-processed foods are marketed to children.
Exactly. These are no longer just nice civic projects or political debates. They are legitimate, urgent, biologically necessary medical interventions.
Because they change the niche. And when you change the niche, the autopoietic organism, the human body, naturally adapts to the new, healthier environment.
You patch the hull of the boat on a societal level.
Exactly. It forces us as a society to reorganize our entire way of living around the conservation and expansion of human life, rather than just waiting to manage the profitable diseases that our environment creates.
Well said.
Okay. We have covered an immense, profound amount of ground today. Let's summarize the journey we've been on.
It's been quite a journey.
We started by looking at chronic, non-communicable diseases.
Yeah.
These massive, stubborn, global issues like diabetes, hypertension, asthma, and heart disease.
Right.
And we've moved completely away from the old, tired narrative that sees these illnesses merely as personal moral failings or a lack of willpower or isolated mechanical defects inside a broken body.
We've moved towards seeing them for what they biologically are. Highly logical, sophisticated adaptations to environments that are often deeply illogical, chronically stressful, and commercially toxic.
Chronic disease is the organism attempting to survive under severe constraint.
It's your body doing its absolute best to keep you alive today in a world that isn't always designed for your long-term well-being.
So for you, listening right now, wherever you are, in your car, walking the dog, at your desk, I want you to take a moment and look at your own organism niche coherence.
A little self-reflection.
Yeah. Look at the daily recurrent loops of your routines. Are those routines forcing your body to constantly fight just to survive the day?
Are you running on endless caffeine and stress hormones, structurally coupled to a work environment or a digital environment that is quietly wearing you down?
Or are you actively trying to shape a niche within your control that allows you to actually thrive?
And please remember, the entire point of this framework is that this is not an exercise in self-blame.
No, absolutely not.
It's an exercise in profound clarity. It's about taking a clear-eyed, objective look at the actual board you are playing on, understanding the constraints, so you can begin to co-create new, feasible domains of action for yourself, your family, and your community.
We want to leave you with a final lingering thought. Throughout this deep dive, we've discussed how your body, specifically your vascular system and your metabolic pathways, is basically a physical tape recorder of your environment.
It records everything.
It absorbs the stress, the food, the pace, the air, and the relationships of your world. If a future historian could somehow read your vascular system and your metabolic health like a history book.
What a thought.
What exact story is your body currently writing about the world you've built around yourself? And more importantly, knowing what you know now, what chapter do you want to start writing tomorrow?